And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, NorCor and ICE are partnering in a new bond measure to increase the funding for detention facilities.
The two groups suspected of sending a threatening email that led to the cancellation of the Rose Parade deny any involvement.
And once again, the Republicans have failed to advance an Obamacare repeal bill out of the House of Representatives.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 28th, 2017, the 99th day of the Trumpocalypse. I'm Ray Bodwell.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. The emailed threat that shut down the Portland 82nd Avenue Rose Parade apparently did not come from either of the groups suspected of generating it. Although the Direct Action Alliance and Oregon Students Empowered wanted to confront racism and other social issues at the parade, both organizations claim that they were not the source of the threat. The Direct Action Alliance says on its Facebook page that, quote, group hashtag 67, which has registered to march at the parade as Oregon Republicans, was actually infiltrated by a group of neo-Nazis and other fascists, but the page makes no mention of shoving participants off the route. Meanwhile, Oregon Students Empowered put a statement on their Facebook page which reads, quote, just to clarify, Oregon Students Empowered had no affiliation to the letter that was sent to the organizers of the Avenue of Rose Parade. 82nd Avenue of Rose Parade, end quote. They go on to say, quote, we wish that the parade organizers could have removed these Nazis from marching in Portland instead of shutting down the parade for everyone who has nothing to do with the threat, end quote. Meanwhile, right-wing publications and broadcasts across, let me restate that, meanwhile, right-wing publications and broadcasts across the nation continue to rage, quoting Multnomah County Republican Chair James Buchall, who said, quote, the bottom line is that Portland needs to choose between supporting terrorist thugs and protecting average citizens who want to participate in their community, end quote. BizPac Review, a right-wing publication, wrote that the parade organizers, quote, cave to the threats of increasingly hostile fascist movement by the left, end quote. But as of this news deadline, neither parade organizers nor authorities had determined the actual source of the threatening email. Nonetheless, the parade that had been scheduled for tomorrow remains canceled.
In a Thursday press conference, Oregon Governor Kate Brown suggested the sale of some state land to pay down debts and reduce the cost of government. The governor said she would appoint a task force to look for properties that can be sold or leveraged to generate cash. She set a November 1st deadline with the hope to implement any recommendations in the short 2018 legislative session. Brown has also said that the state must do a better job of collecting the debts owed by taxpayers and suppliers, and that it must negotiate better contracts and labor agreements. Brown's plan does not include the sale of state parkland or the privatization of prisons. The governor and legislators are being driven by an estimated $1.6 million shortfall in this budget cycle and the looming $22 billion debt that the state owes to the public employees' retirement system.
NorCor stands for the Northern Oregon Regional Correctional Facilities. It's the result of the combined efforts of Wasco, Hood River, Sherman, and Gillam counties, and prides itself on leading the national standard on prisons and juvenile detention centers. The newest NorCor facility in Hood River is being established with the assistance of money from the Immigration Customs Enforcement Agency, otherwise known as ICE. KBOO's Zelos Marchant has this report.
Wasco, Hood River, Sherman, and Gilman counties have all merged to develop the most recent NorCor facility in Hood River with the assistance of money from the Immigration Customs Enforcement Agency. NorCor, Oregon's regional correctional facility system, prides itself on setting national best practices for prisons and juvenile detention centers, but it has recently been found moving beyond complicity in its financial partnerships with the Immigration Customs Enforcement Agency. I spoke with Tim Setchell in Hood River, a business owner and local activist, about the large uptick in beds reserved for immigration detentioners and the swell of money that is poured into the NorCor facility. He said, quote, it is still kind of mysterious where the money is going, end quote. The tension arrangements with ICE and NorCor are not new in Hood River. But with the various nearby counties desperately needing income, ICE offered $2 million to help build and maintain the local prison, with the understanding that it would require more reserved beds and more money for its raiding agendas. The original 2012-2013 budget included a $180,000 contract for ICE detention programs. The current budget contract is now $1.5 million and includes adding detention beds in the Hood River Juvenile Detention Center. Tim Setchell is one of thousands of prospering business owners in Hood River in agricultural and consulting fields whose success depends on the large immigrant community. It has turned many business owners into activists. As ICE is maintaining a stronger, more bold presence, many farmers and winemakers have had to band together and self-educate about ways to protect their workers against ICE with local activists and law groups. According to the Dallas Chronicle, there is a proposed bond measure for Hood River to continue this contentious partnership with ICE in the wake of a perpetually problematic deficit. Molly Rogers, Director of Youth Services from Wasco County, had this to say about a town whose federal contacts have never been consistent and have led to layoffs in order to break even. Quote, "I know ICE kind of looks good right now, but there are no guarantees," end quote. It remains to be seen what the true cost of breaking even will be in the long run. This is Zelos Machant for KBOO News.
OPAL and the Oregon Just Transition Alliance are urging Portlanders to join them for the People's Climate March tomorrow, the 100th day of the Trump presidency. The event will kick off at Dorsland Park at North Williams and North Stanton at noon and will include public education to explain the climate connection to a wide range of racial and social justice issues. Following the program of speakers, marchers will head out at 1:30 and follow a route that will lead them to Buckman Park by 3 p.m. The march will conclude with participating organizations providing information to participants on how to become involved in the climate justice movement. For more information, listeners should go to www.opalpdx.org.
According to the report from Emory University, Oregon leads the nation in per capita deaths from hepatitis C. Oregon's mortality rate of 15 per 100,000 is nearly 2.5 times the national average, and the estimated infection rate of over 3,000 per 100,000 is in the upper tier as well. Hepatitis C is a blood-borne virus that is frequently transmitted by intravenous drug users, but can also be transmitted through organ transplants, blood transfusions, or unsterilized tools from tattoo parlors. Left untreated, the virus can lead to liver damage, cirrhosis, and cancer of the liver. And the estimates were those estimates were generated by Emory in a project supported by the Centers for Disease Control. The CDC estimates that 3.9 million Americans have antibodies to hepatitis C, indicating that they have or have had the virus. Deaths from hepatitis C surpass the combined total of 60 of the most commonly reported infectious diseases, including HIV, pneumococcal disease, and tuberculosis. According to hephope.com, treatments for the disease are available.
On Wednesday, pranksters managed to grind one of Donald Trump's pet projects to a halt. That was the day that his Victims of Immigration Crime Engagement, or VOICE, hotline was launched. The hotline, which Trump promised during his February address to Congress, was meant to provide a means for individuals to report crimes that were committed by, quote, an alien who may be subject to removal. But critics mounted a Twitter campaign with the hashtag Alien Day, urging people to call the voice line and report alien takeovers and encounters with space invaders. Fox News reported that a Department of Homeland Security official told them that the fake reports had resulted in significant delays in the hotline's response time. The website Snopes reported that they had failed in four separate attempts to get through on the line. Alexander McCoy, a former Marine and founder of the Common Defense Political Action Committee, claims to have devised the campaign to combat the Trump administration's bigoted language and racist stereotyping. He also pointed out that the prank coincided with Alien Day, a celebration of the Alien film series. the last-ditch effort to get Donald Trump a repeal of the Affordable Care Act within his first 100 days failed today, as House Republicans once again withdrew the bill before a vote. The revised bill allowed states to opt out of key Obamacare requirements and had gained the support of the ultra-conservative.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather calls for a cloudy but mild day, with temperatures reaching the mid-60s. East of the Cascades and Hood River, you can expect similar conditions, but with temperatures a few degrees higher. On this day in 1967, boxing champion Muhammad Ali refused to be indicted into the U.S. Army. Ali, a Muslim, said, quote, "I ain't got no quarrel with those Viet Cong," end quote, and cited religious reasons for his refusal. He was immediately stripped of his heavyweight title. The quote of the day is from Ali, who said, quote, "Hating people because of their color is wrong, and it doesn't matter which color does the hating. It's just plain wrong."
Ali, catch me if you can.
Since 2000, Free Speech Radio News' mission has been to provide factual reports on important international and domestic news stories often missing in the corporate press, and to amplify the voices of the ignored and unheard. Those voices have been broadcast on radio stations across the U.S. in tens of thousands of news stories spanning 17 years. Today, FSRN is itself in the news because of the stories they will no longer be able to tell. They are discontinuing operations due to financial constraints. The very first story reported by Lena Nozizwe, produced for FSRN, was about a transgender college student. Today, her last report is about the beginnings and the end of FSRN. Next week, the KBOO News team will put together a retrospective replaying some of FSRN's most impactful stories.
This is the first broadcast of Free Speech Radio News. The producers are members of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship.
The year was 2000. The state of Vermont became the first to pass legislation legalizing same-sex couple unions. Hillary Clinton was elected to the U.S. Senate. And in a contested presidential race, the Supreme Court ruled that George W. Bush was the winner. 2000 also marked the birth of Free Speech Radio News, founded when a group of reporters went on strike against the Pacifica Radio Network. The strikers said management was censoring coverage of internal politics at the flagship community radio organization. Independent radio stations across the country supported the strike by airing the newscast.
One of my first recollections of Free Speech Radio News was when it split from Pacifica and became an entity all to its own, an entity that was very collective in its nature, which was rather unique.
General manager of WERU in Blue Hill, Maine, Matt Murphy was a listener and fan from the beginning.
This was an independent group and a group that we really valued very much. Free Speech Radio News rapidly became our daily news that came on the airwaves just before Democracy Now!
FSRN became a worker-run collective and pioneered the decentralized newsroom model with production staff in different cities around the world, rather than concentrated in media hubs like New York or Washington, D.C. Nell Abrams soon joined the international team.
Staff were in their offices or their homes or their studios all around the world and gathered via conference calls to make decisions about what stories they could cover.
FSRN, St. Petersburg, Russia.
Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
That was part of the allure for former FSRN anchor Dorian Marina.
On any given day at FSRN, you could have an editor sitting in New Delhi, another in Oaxaca, Mexico, a producer in Miami, Florida, another in Los Angeles, and another still in the Philippines. And to me, this is what made FSRN so special. You had a network of people from all over the globe coming together to decide what story should be told and how they should be told. And it made for something unlike anything else on the air during its time.
More than 100 stations around the country soon began airing the daily newscast. One of them was KPFT in Houston, where FSRN grabbed the attention of Shannon Young as a listener in 2002.
That's when I heard Fariba Nawa on FSRN.
I've been searching for a new angle on Afghan women to report on, aside from the normal "We're so oppressed, America, come and save us" reporting in the mainstream media so often. Oddly enough, the story came running to me today.
She had phoned in a commentary that succinctly summed up just why it's so important to go to journalists who are from or who live in the communities they report on, precisely because they understand and can convey a nuance that outsiders simply don't pick up on.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Fariba Nawa in Kabul.
During 17 years of reporting the news, often ignored in the corporate media, hundreds of reporters around the world amplified the voices of the people in their communities, content that went into producing more than 23,000 headlines, features, and documentaries heard on more than 100 stations around the United States. Then in late 2013, all of FSRN's voices, including Nawa's, were silenced. The program ran out of funding after their main client and distributor fell months behind and then defaulted on payments. During the silence, a skeleton team retooled and a few months later relaunched as FSRN, the weekly edition. Since early 2014, FSRN has been produced and edited by a bare-bones staff of two, Abram and Young, plus part-time technical engineer Roe Packard. But even so, producing the program comes at a price that FSRN is no longer able to pay. Despite continued support from individual members and carriage fees paid by radio stations, it's simply not enough. Abram says credible and well-produced content is expensive.
We've had no luck finding major funding, like grants from foundations or organizational support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And despite station carriage, our direct distribution using social media has been slashed by algorithms that drastically limit the reach of our content.
The loss is already felt by news director Eileen Alfandari, who says FSRN has been a staple at KPFA Community Radio in Berkeley, a station that was supportive of the initial strike that led to FSRN's creation.
and she wonders about the impact on journalism.
FSRN's demise comes at a time when too much of the news has been reduced to short sound bites or, yes, tweets. And the commitment of FSRN to dive deep into an issue has been more important than ever. I am also concerned about what happens to the freelance journalists who've been filing for FSRN and whether this will tip some of them out of the field, whether this will be, you know, the straw that breaks the camel's back. Especially at this time, we need more of this independent journalism, not less. And I am very, very sorry to see FSRN go.
And she's not the only one.
Sam Cowie for FSRN, Brasilia.
Khalid Sidmohand, FSRN, Paris.
Martha Baskin, FSRN, Seattle.
From Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
Lana Nozizwe, FSRN, Los Angeles.
In an interview with Reuters on Thursday, Donald Trump said, quote, "There is a chance that we could end up having a major, major conflict with North Korea," end quote. But according to the Hankook Ilbo newspaper in Seoul, South Korea, President Trump has asked former President Jimmy Carter not to repeat his 1994 visit. Carter's visit resulted in the release of three American prisoners in North Korea and is now recognized to have brought both nations back from the brink of war in 1994. In addition, it resulted in a peace agreement between the United States and North Korea. But rather than attempt negotiations, the U.S. now is ramping up the tension by continuing to deploy weaponry in and around South Korea. China has bluntly demanded the removal of the U.S. weapons system known as the Theater High Altitude Defense Anti-Missile Rockets, or THAAD. Chinese Foreign Minister spokesman Zheng Shuang said Wednesday, quote, "Cancel the deployment of THAAD. Otherwise, China will decisively take necessary measures," end quote. Ohio Governor John Kasich added to the tensions of the Korean Peninsula by implying that the United States should assassinate North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. In her interview with the Christian Science Monitor, Kasich said, quote, "I think there might be a way, and that has to do with taking out the North Korean leadership. I'll just leave it there," end quote. Evidently, he forgot that assassination of world leaders is contrary to international law. And North Korea has warned of the immediate outbreak of war should such an assassination attempt be made. Meanwhile, the deployed militaries of both nations stand at maximum alert. North Korea has broadcast videos of the nuclear destruction of U.S. cities, and the U.S. has deployed a carrier strike group, as well as the nuclear submarines USS Michigan and USS Columbia, to the area.
For those of you keeping score at home, this week Republicans in the U.S. House of Representatives made what was actually their third attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Once again, it failed to advance, as many nervous representatives remembered the strong responses they had received from their constituents. Earlier today, I had an opportunity to work with the Oregon News Service on this report. The last-ditch effort to get Donald Trump a repeal of the Affordable Care Act within his first 100 days failed today, as House Republicans once again withdrew the bill before a vote. The revised bill allowed states to opt out of key Obamacare requirements and had gained the support of the ultra-conservative House Freedom Caucus. But those revisions drove away moderate Republicans. So despite their strong majority in the House of Representatives, Republicans were once again unable to garner the 216 votes necessary to advance the bill to the Senate. Democrats threatened a government shutdown if Republicans brought the American Health Care Act up for a vote before voting on a budget plan. And many of the groups who opposed the original version of Trump Care felt equally strongly about the updated plan. Here's Joyce DeMonen, Communications Director for AARP Oregon.
We think the American Health Care Act is a bad bill that just keeps getting worse for older adults, and it's just a shame that we're playing games with people's lives.
Under the revised American Health Care Act, states could allow insurers to charge people with pre-existing conditions higher premiums. It would also allow states to opt out of the individual mandate that required people to get health coverage or pay a penalty that had been put in place under Obamacare. AARP is opposed to the legislation because it still contains a so-called age tax. Under the current system, insurance companies can only charge older Americans three times what they charge younger people. That cap is lifted under the AHCA, and according to DeMonen, the bill does not address the increasing cost of health care.
AARP believes that Congress should be addressing the skyrocketing cost of health care, and especially prescription drugs, instead of boosting profits for drug companies and insurance companies.
DeMonen says that she and her organization are also frustrated because the bill includes an exemption for members of Congress so that they cannot be charged higher premiums for pre-existing conditions. For the Oregon News Service and KBOO, this is Ray Botwell.
A Texas court has ordered ExxonMobil to pay a $20 million fine for pollutants released into the air at the Baytown, Texas refinery and chemical plant. The fine resulted from a lawsuit by the Sierra Club and the Texas Citizen Environment Lobby. U.S. District Judge David Hintner cited serious violations and noted that the energy giant violated the Clean Air Act 16,386 times between October of 2005 and September of 2013. Exxon's Baytown, Texas refinery and the chemical facility is one of the largest and most complex industrial sites in the country. The court found that Exxon gained a $14 million benefit by delaying the installation of monitoring improvements that might have prevented the releases. Neil Carman of the Sierra Club stated that, quote, "Today's decision sends a resounding message that it will not pay to pollute in Texas," end quote. Exxon, which is headquartered in Texas, said that they disagreed with the court's decision and the award of a penalty. The company will likely appeal the ruling. Exxon is also being investigated for allegedly misleading the public and shareholders about what it knew about the dangers of climate change. The company has denied all wrongdoing. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. If you would like to be part of the KBOO News crew, call us or stop by the station. We'd love to have you on our team. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ray Bodwell, Teresa Mitchell, and Jasmine Moneymaker. The producer is Ray Bodwell. An extra special thanks to Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant.